from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Dave Iverson. New research from UC Berkeley and other local universities suggests that heterosexual married couples are more likely to stick together if the wife functions as the emotional grown-up in the room when they fight and calms down first. The study tracked 80 couples from the Bay Area over 20 years, analyzing video of their fights and the aftermath. In an age when many Americans are choosing to bowl alone, scientists are asking tough questions about one of the toughest challenges human beings face, how to build and maintain loving relationships. We'll discuss the findings with two of the study's lead researchers and take your calls coming up on Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro, in today for Dave Iverson. We've all been there, arguing with a partner or spouse, but unsure how to resolve the conflict without damaging the relationship, or worried the conflict is a red flag, the relationship is doomed. In recent years, science has begun to inform the discussion with fascinating revelations about how our brains work and how body chemistry affects our perceptions when it comes to social interaction. Today, we talk about the latest study from Bay Area researchers that suggests married women really do have the upper hand if they can back off their anger and upset first during a fight. Let's talk to the lead researchers now. We've got Robert Levinson, a professor in the Department of Psychology and director of the Institute of Personality and Social Research at UC Berkeley, and senior author of the study. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having us.
We also have Leon Block, a licensed psychologist and assistant professor in, bear with me now, the PGSP Stanford PsyD Consortium. Did I get that right?
That's correct.
You're also the lead author of the study, Emotion Regulation Predicts Marital Satisfaction, More Than a Wives' Tale. So if you can, Leon Block, explain this study. What were the parameters? There haven't been a lot of longitudinal studies of this kind.
Yeah, absolutely. So this study actually began back in 1989 by Robert Levinson, our other guest here today, who started this really visionary study on marriage and emotion. And he started back in 89 tracking this sample of middle-aged and older heterosexual long-term married couples. And from this extremely rich data set that we've derived over the last 20 years, we found that the marriages that were the happiest were the ones in which the wives were able to calm down most efficiently during marital conflict.
Now, tell me, Professor Levinson, this is not just a wide-ranging group. It's 80 specific couples. They're from the Bay Area. They're baby boomers, members of the greatest generation, the World War II generation.
Yeah, it was 156 couples that we started with in 1989, and half of them were in their 40s, and they'd been married at least 15 years, and the other half were in their 60s, they'd been married at least 35 years. So the younger group is the baby boomers. The older group, sort of the children of the Great Depression, they grew up in a very, very different time. And we wanted the couples to represent the Bay Area. So we started by hiring a survey research company that randomly called phone numbers in the whole Bay Area and figured out exactly what the modal long-term marriage looked like in terms of education and income and religion in these two age groups. And then we constructed a sample. So it's not just any sample, but it's really a snapshot of what these kinds of marriages look like in our part of the world at this particular time.
And what, you got a couple into a room and then videotaped them arguing? How did it work, actually?
That's how it works. And I think that's what's unusual about this. First, that we were so dogged to keep it going for so long. But when we started this kind of work, most of what we knew about marriage was based on surveys. So we would very well organized surveys where you ask people what they think about what makes their marriages work. And you know, we all have a lot of opinions about that. But sometimes we don't see very clearly, you know, when it's our own relationships. And what was unusual about this is that this is based on making a movie of couples at work. talking about topics of things they enjoy and things that they disagree in. And we use that those data, those video records, very careful coding to see what couples actually do and what they actually feel and how those relate to what happens to their marriage over decades.
Leon Block, explain a little bit the finding that women, if they sort of back off on the emotional ire in a fight, can affect the quality of the marriage. What does that mean specifically?
Sure. So I think there's a couple additional aspects of this study that warrant mentioning. So I originally mentioned that it's really about the wives calming down that impacts the couple's marital satisfaction or how happy they are in their marriage. What's really kind of interesting is that we also found that husbands and wives were actually equally good at this task of kind of calming down during a fight. And I think one of the things that points to actually goes back to the cohorts that Bob was alluding to, which is, you know, this was a very specific cohort of adults, some of whom or many of whom came into their marriages in an era where we had books like John Gray's Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus that were dominating the bestseller charts. And so there's a very specific set of gendered stereotypes about emotion, and particularly as women being the emotional centers of a marriage. And so one of the things that we utilize that for in interpreting our finding is that the couples in this study were looking to the women, to the wives, as markers or emotional thermometers of how things were going in their marriage. And so while both spouses were actually good at calming down, they were also kind of selectively attending to the wives' ability to do so. And this was what really had the profound implications. And I think that's a very interesting aspect of the finding and, you know, suggests that if we had perhaps were to replicate this study with younger couples, we may find something different.
I that's exactly what I thought as I first looked at this study, that Gen Xers, millennials don't necessarily carry the same expectations, the same gender stereotypes. In fact, we were born, or grew up in a world that's kind of post-feminist revolution in terms of talking about women's rights and talking about gender stereotypes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that we can all be hopeful that these gender stereotypes are evolving. And I think one of the things in terms of practical implications that this points to for couples is that, the results of this study are descriptive, not prescriptive. In other words, in our sample, we found that wives were really privileged in this way, in these relationships with regard to managing emotion. But that doesn't mean that's how it has to be. And I think, you know, whether you're from that older cohort or a younger cohort, or you're a wife or a husband in a heterosexual marriage, there's opportunity to sort of consciously think about, how am I attending to emotion from each partner in a marriage? And also opportunities to consciously attend to how emotion is handled in conflict. And in fact, you know, stepping back to the broader world of couples therapy, that's really what we do, right? We look at these automatized, habitual patterns of interacting and have an opportunity to change them.
Professor Levin, can you speak to that, these automatized habits? We were talking about the pursuer, the distancer. Couples therapists listening to this conversation go, oh, yes, I see that a lot. And it does seem that, you know, whether you're talking about men, women, same-sex couples, older, younger, that there are certain patterns that emerge.
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things that are important to think about. So first of all, this is not a message, don't argue, mm-hmm. or, you know, that if you're in a relationship, somehow the fact that you're arguing means you're doing something wrong. Conflict, argument, disagreement is built into the fabric of every relationship, every intimate relationship. You're going to have to deal with it. You might put it off for a while and, you know, you might have a long honeymoon period, but eventually this is going to be one of the basic litmus tests of whether your relationship is going to thrive or not. So that's the first thing, that there's really nothing to worry about, that you have disagreements. And what's interesting about this finding, I think, is it sort of says the way you deal with these disagreements provides the answer, you know, for how the couple is going to fare. And you have to take into account differences between spouses. In this time, in this era, in this sample, gender is a huge factor. But in another era, in another sample, it might be something else. So, you know, with the millennials or with same-sex couples, it may not be men and women, but it may be, well, who has the power? Or who wants to maintain the status quo? There's always going to be disagreement. And, you know, there's always going to be this need to both deal with the disagreement, but also deal with the emotions that are produced around it. And I think those are universals. I don't think that'll ever change. And I think, you know, it's going to be really important to focus on not only what you argue about, but how to cool down.
And I think to build on that comment, that another finding in this study was that the wives who were able to calm down efficiently during conflict were then able to use more constructive communication strategies, just like Bob was alluding to. In other words, they were able to express feelings clearly, to suggest solutions, compromises to the conflict at hand, which makes it more likely that conflict resolution will happen. And so I think that building on his point that conflict is not only inevitable, and it's also valuable in that it allows couples to air these potential areas of disagreement and dissatisfaction and then to repair them. So in the long run, it really can support even stronger relationships, provided that the emotion and subsequent communication is handled effectively and utilized effectively.
Can you give an example of that, Professor Block? I mean, I wonder, for some people who maybe just read the headline or who read, you know, a really short, snappy write-up that kind of bottlerizes what you guys are actually talking about on the web, it may sound like you're asking women to sort of eat their rage, to hold back their feelings and, you know, try and, you know, marshal their resources to use intellect to come up with an answer. Mm. What would be an example of how a conflict is effectively resolved?
So couples argue all the time over how to raise their children. And underneath that is a sort of a implied accusation that you haven't done a good job. And so I'm telling you in our relationship that you really have let our kids down. And, you know, our kids are not doing well in school and they don't have a lot of friends. And, you know, I'm worried that they're just not going to be successful in life. And, you know, you're hearing that and it's pretty irritating because you've invested a lot in these kids. And you know, you're quite angry. And so that's a sort of a part of your brain responding, that it's the same part of the brain that on the savannah kept you alive when, you know, you were threatened by a tiger or something. But you need to multitask a little bit and you need to think, well, you know, I need to give my husband a little bit of advice here, that one, these are very hurtful words. And that, you know, there may be other ways of dealing with this and make some suggestions. You know, at some point you need to stop accusing each other and talk about what you're going to do to do the best job of being parents together, and particularly to work on it in a team-like way, you know, where it's not me against you. Now, that's a lot of stuff to have going on in your brain at one time. And I think that's the challenge. That's why it's not easier to do. But to the extent that you can kind of do that and hear both of the, you know, recognize your anger, but also recognize that there's a way out of this. And at least in this sample, it's not fair, but women are being asked to sort of do both of these things at once and sort of help their husbands know how to navigate their way through these disagreements. In this generation, in this cohort, men are very prone to back off and shut down in these situations. And when things get heated, it's a very common pattern that men just look away and look down and withdraw from the conversation. So it's one of these things where you're asking a lot of women, but you know, women in this cohort are very good at this, and I think couples can get better at sort of supporting each other and not making it such the wife has to solve the problem. The goal is still the same. You have to deal with the feelings, and you have to find a way towards solving the problem.
Professor Block?
Yeah, and I think just to add on that you know, you sort of asked us as well about, are women just supposed to shut it off and suppress it and hold it in, which I think we all, men and women alike, have experienced how aversive that is and how aversive it is to be told, certainly, to be doing that. And I think really the take home is that actually these emotions, even the negative ones, are super valuable. They're so functionally important, as Bob was alluding to, all the way back to our, you know, days as cave people. And that how we're thinking about this is, if you can, you know, identify, recognize, and clearly express those negative feelings, that's a feature of effective and constructive communication. So it's not that the emotions shouldn't be part of the conversation. It's just how they can then be harnessed to also have a solution-focused conversation.
I suppose it's worth mentioning that for the really big arguments that couples have, they don't just happen in one discrete time and space. They happen over days, weeks, years even. And so you have the opportunity both perhaps to express your animal rage and then think about it and come back at the problem with the benefit of time and thought and experience.
One of the things that's amazing about doing this kind of research and then looking at these home movies of couples arguing is you can sort of cue them up at every 5 years and listen to what it is they're talking about. And more often than not, it's the same topic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's the same core issue being, like you said, revisited with 5 more years of experience and 5 more years of being together and 5 more years of triumphs and frustrations. But the topic never changes. It's really quite striking.
It sounds awful, though. I mean, Groundhog Day, right? You're living it out. Didn't we just have this argument? I feel like I'm saying the same things.
Yeah. But you get better. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that we've noticed, it is so striking and interesting to then. And I think one of the coolest things about Bob having established the study back in 89 and as he was alluding to, having that stamina to continue to follow these couples, it's incredibly interesting, is the topics are also sort of interestingly consistent across couples and hit on some, you know, very interesting and perhaps unsurprising things ranging from how to raise children, who's doing housework, finances, and sex. And I think those really sort of pop, again, perhaps in unsurprising ways. Another thing that's sort of interesting that we've observed over time as these conversations about the same content have continued is that in some of the older couples, they have this interesting response, the ones who sort of really made it the long haul over the course and didn't divorce, and is this adaptive style of saying, you know, We've fought about this for so many years and kind of shifting to more of a style of laughing it off, which is an interesting and we think an adaptive response style.
Yeah, and there's some really great couples therapists who have sort of used this approach as a way of helping couples deal with these. A fellow who I've worked with quite a bit in the last few years at Berkeley is a therapist named Dan Weil, who's written several books on marriage. And he talks about couples needing to get on a platform where they can kind of look at that problem from a distance together. And it really takes the fangs out of it. And so I think that the couples who do well find that platform on their own, but there's actually some hope that you can help people learn that strategy.
Given that you've been looking at these couples over the course of so many years, have your own theories changed in the light of some of the new work we've seen come out in recent years on social psychology and attachment parenting?
You know, I think that this study, I don't know if you want to talk, Bob, at all about any parenting aspects of the study that have come out, that this was much more of a focus on marriages. And in particular, you know, an interesting question that actually came up yesterday was about, well, these are not only marriages, but these are very normal marriages. And the question was raised, well, why not look at abnormal marriages, or why not look at the, you know, marriages in crisis? And I think this is a little bit tangential from your question, but reminded me of this. I think it is an important point is, you know, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, more than 96% of Americans marry at least once in their lives. And I think one thing that's very interesting about this area of study is it really captures a very modal American experience. So many people marry. And the opportunity to study these normal marriages is very fascinating. And marriages are not only frequent in that way, but they're also potent, I'd like to say, which is that, you know, whether these normal marriages fare well or fare poorly has huge consequences for the spouses who are in those relationships, as we all know, you know, perhaps from our own long-term relationships, huge implications for individuals' sense of their subjective well-being, for their physical health, for their mental health. And so this is a really...
And huge implications for their children, yeah.
Although I guess what I'm sort of trying to get at with that last question is think, God, you know, psychology fashions have come and gone. Nobody these days, well, very few people talk about, you know, Freudian psychology, the id, the super ego. We haven't opened the brain and discovered those areas yet. You know, the language people use, the framing people use to describe what's happening to them now, describe what they think happened to them as children, sort of setting their personalities in shape.
Yeah, I think one of the great joys of a life in science is that at every juncture you find out you're wrong. It's really a path of discovery of your own limitations, because everything you at one time thought was true turns out to be not exactly right. That's about as good as it gets, and often just dead wrong. So 25 years ago when we started this study, the typical treatment for couples in marital distress was individual psychotherapy for the two individuals. The idea was that the reason marriages don't do well is because husbands and wives have psychopathologies of their own. They have depression and anxiety. If you could just fix that, the marriage would be fine. Of course, it's totally silly. I mean, if you just fix that, maybe their lives are better, but the marriage still probably has the same problems. People thought that they had a very behavioral approach, and they thought that if you can just learn how to communicate better, you'll have a better marriage. So people would go into marital therapy, and they would be taught things like, you can't speak until you convince your partner that you've heard accurately what she said. And then they would go back and forth. They would like pass the baton when it was time to be totally worthless. You know, we didn't have a very good sense of how important emotion was at the beginning of this. Attachment is an old idea in marital therapy, but now we're really kind of understanding that as well. And it turns out positive emotions are really important as well as negative emotions. So it's an explosion of knowledge.
We're talking about conflict in romantic relationships. We can't do therapy over the air, but tell us what you would love to hear these researchers talk about. We're asking people, how do you de-escalate during a fight? Give us your tips and tricks. Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org, post on our Facebook page, or head to our website, kqed.org/forum. Whatever your mode of communication, we are ready for your comments and questions. We'll be back in just a moment. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, sitting in for Dave Iverson. We're talking about conflict in relationships, the good, the bad, and the ugly. We're talking with Robert Levinson, professor of the Department of Psychology and director of the Institute of Personality and Social Research at UC Berkeley, and senior author of a study looking at Bay Area couples, really, over the course of some 20 years. Also, Assistant Professor Leon Block at the PGSP Stanford Psi D. Consortium, which is, you know, another way to describe it would be a joint clinical psychology doctoral program taught by faculty from both Palo Alto and Stanford universities. You know, we were talking during the break about the divorce rate still at 50%, despite all the research, despite all of the, you know, thoughtful literature written on the subject, despite the efforts of, you know, cadres of couples therapists trying to help people through this. Any thoughts as to what we're doing wrong? Or are we doing something right and it's just a really hard thing, this thing called marriage? Either of you want to kick that off?
I guess I can comment from my purview as a couples therapist and just as someone who happens to be married. I think it is a really hard thing. And this is not a scientific comment I'm about to make, but I think that, you know, you take two individuals and the concept of marriage is really unifying them around one life together, a shared life together. And so one of the things I often tell clients who come in for couples therapy is there's each of you as individual spouses, and there's sort of this third entity in the room, which is the relationship, and how challenging it is to attune to the needs of each spouse and the relationship. And sometimes I think the relationship gets lost in the focus on individual spouses. And alternatively, sometimes the individual spouse's needs get lost in the focus on the relationship. And I think this is just a really tricky, naturally tricky balance for humans to strike.
Professor Levinson?
Well, you know, in a funny way, this is exactly why we did the study, because almost all of the research prior to this that we were involved in, and most other people in the field, studied failures. You'd grab a bunch of people whose marriages ended in divorce, and you try to understand it. And I remember distinctly when we thought we'd started this study, and it was myself and Laura Carstensen at Stanford and John Gottman, who was at the University of Washington. And we were talking, I think it was in Marcello's Pizza one night, and we said, why don't we study the people who don't fail? And so we thought, let's look at people who've gotten through the early challenges, like having kids, which is huge bump in the divorce rate. And they've gotten to the point in their marriages where they've gotten over some of the early issues. And we saw these as sort of the champions of marriage. And let's get a bunch of these people who have been together for a while and let's see what we can learn from them. So, you know, time will tell. But this is an unusual sample in that way because they are the successes. We have a very low divorce rate in this sample, because we didn't pick them up until they'd been married at least 15 years in the middle age group or 35 years in the older group.
Well, I'm going to challenge you, though, on the definition of success. I mean, think of all the great works of literature, the fabulous movies that have been made about people who may be a success in the sense that they're still married after 15 or 30 years, but they've ossified, sometimes in horrifically dynamic relationships that appall and even abuse other people in their circle. How does one define success?
Yeah, well, I think that's also very consistent with sort of ageist views of what emotion is like in late life. And it turns out that's not the case. So, for example, if you look at these couples as they move over this 20-year period, there isn't any diminution in emotion, in the emotional qualities of their relationship, but the palate shifts. So it's more emotionally positive and less emotionally negative. These are still vibrant emotional relationships, but you know they've gotten better over time. I mean, not that they're perfect, but that you know there is they are emotional and they are more emotionally positive. And that it took this study for us to really know whether that's the case or not. And there's just no question about it. These are not empty shells where people are just phoning it in.
Professor Block?
Yeah, I think, you know, and your question about these ossified relationships and how do we define successful relationships, I think, you know, we also don't want to overstate that that staying married is necessarily successful, is necessarily the sort of pinnacle of achievement in a relationship. Because, you know, I think you make a great point that oftentimes patterns in relationships, whether they be positive or negative, do become ossified over the long term. And we engage in these habitual, automatic approaches to relating to one another, and it's almost inevitable. You know, as human beings, we operate with heuristics all the time because it helps us function more efficiently. Unfortunately, sometimes those heuristics, whether it be the way that we're viewing our partner, who we think our partner is, or how we interact with our partner, can become toxic and perpetuated. And so I think that gold standard is not necessarily staying together, but rather I think there's a hopeful opportunity to shift those patterns of relating to one another, or sometimes, you know, separating or divorcing if that is the most useful, helpful outcome for the couple at hand.
Let's turn to the phones now. We have Josh in Sacramento.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was hoping to hear if the researchers could explain how, in their observations, they accounted for the research subjects being observed and behavioral changes caused by that awareness.
Fabulous question.
It's a real challenge for doing this kind of work because you bring people into the laboratory and we try to make it as natural a setting as possible, but it isn't their real life. And, you know, they are on stage in a funny way. So we do a number of things. One thing we do is we always start our sessions with them with a kind of a half an hour of just talking about what's been going on in their life. We don't make much. We don't use that for data, but it gives them a chance to get used to the procedures. We also cultivate a relationship with these couples. I mean, the real heroes of this research are the 156 couples who we've been working with for 20 years because, you know, we've been part of their lives and they know who we are. And I think over time, we become like the friends that they visit every few years. The other thing about this is that there is, and I think you'll probably know this in your own experience, but there is something compelling about being in a conversation, talking about something you care about with someone who you really are invested in. So maybe you've had this experience. You're in a restaurant, a public place, and all of a sudden you realize you're talking about incredibly private and intimate things. And it's almost like you forget that there's anybody else in the room. So there's something very powerful about this conversing with someone you care about, which makes some of the artificiality go away.
And perhaps they develop more and more comfort over the years as they're in the space again and again.
Oh yeah, and you know this is a touch point. You know when they come back after 5 years, we have them start by bringing us up to date. You know about their lives, and you know we try to send them cards on their anniversaries, and you know we try to make this something that is a partnership.
We asked our listeners on Facebook how they and their partners de-escalate conflicts, and we've got some responses back. Leah says, luck plus good judgment has served us well. Katie writes, we have learned to try and see the other person's side, even if we don't necessarily agree. We never go to bed angry. Sometimes our conflicts are because we're both hungry and therefore cranky. As we learn more about each other, it helps make conflicts that much easier to solve. Life is too short to fight with the one you love. But then we have this comment from a listener. One of the most common pieces of advice given to me as a newlywed was, don't go to bed angry. But that simply doesn't seem practical. My partner and I go to bed angry all the time, if for no other reason than because we need to get some sleep so that we're not zombies at work the next day. Can your guest speak to the validity of that age-old advice?
It's probably really bad advice. I mean, you're going to go to bed angry. There's no one-size-fits-all here. One of the things you have to figure out is the sort of the emotional culture of your own relationship. And maybe you're in the kind of relationship where it takes a night going to bed angry to sort of prime you to have a really good discussion 2 days later. And maybe that's one of the things you learn by being together for – so like in our sample, our older couples have now all been together over 50 years. Maybe you learn that you don't talk about things right away. You let them sit for a while.
Percolate.
Yeah, right. And I think that's – how you get there is going to differ for each couple. But the point of this study is that learning how to calm down – and cool down after these fights, however you do it, is going to be critical it's critically related to how happy your relationship's going to be.
What's your thought on this, listener? Are you the kind of person that that makes sure you put the argument to bed before you go to bed, or do you let it percolate over days, weeks, years? Call us at 866-733-6786 or email us at forum@kqed.org. Bill emails, can the conclusions of the study be extrapolated to apply to gay and lesbian couples? Professor Levinson?
We, in this study, only had heterosexual couples, and but we have done several studies using this methodology with gay and lesbian couples in the Bay Area, and we have done some shorter follow-ups, looking at 4 and 5 year follow-ups in these couples, and it's a very interesting picture, I think. So the bottom line is, a lot more that's similar than different. And we went into it with some, I think, some naive ideas. And we thought, for example, because men tend to withdraw from conflict, if you had two men in an intimate relationship, they would just withdraw and withdraw and they would never argue. And because women like to sit with feelings, these are stereotypes, if you had two women in an intimate relationship, once they started, it would never end. Well, it turns out it doesn't work that way at all. In almost all things that we've looked at, certainly the recipe for relationship success is the same. We found some interesting small differences. So one of the things we found in one study is that same-sex couples don't get trapped in the corner as much. So, you know, sometimes heterosexual couples get so activated and so hostile that they really just become paralyzed. And we didn't see that as much. Gay couples would get really angry or, you know, really sad, but they often would find their way back to some sort of equilibrium. So, you know, bottom line, more alike than similar, but some interesting subtle differences that seem to go with partnering with someone of your own sex.
Disclosure here, I'm a Gen Xer. I have to say, I don't know a lot of men who are emotional blockheads. I don't know a lot of tempestuous women. But then I'm not there at 11 o'clock at night when they're in the bedroom arguing. Is there a notable difference, I mean, that you can tell, maybe not from this study, but from your peripheral awareness of research, a notable difference between baby boomers and the generations coming up?
Well, you know, I think It does get back to that one aspect of the study, just to reference the current one that we've been talking about, which is that actually men and women were equally good at calming down emotionally, meaning it sort of defies those maybe older cohort gendered stereotypes about men being, as you alluded to, emotional blockheads, because that's not what we found. So I think, you know, that that's certainly, you know, you drive home that point.
Well, with that, let's go to another call. We've got Lisa in Mountain View.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
Question, were any of these study participants, were any of them afflicted with a mental illness of any type or, you know, personality disorder, substance abuse, et cetera? And how did that impact the result?
Yeah, we tended to screen for people who had serious substance abuse problems, but everything else was allowed to vary pretty much in the way that it would in a representative sample. And so one of the things that we're doing now, you know, this is like a cake that it took us 20 years to bake. We just took it out of the oven a few years ago, and now the question is, well, what piece do you eat first? And one of the really important pieces that we are studying is what this tells us about both the impact of health, which is your question, I think, but also how marriage affects health. Mm-hmm. And because we did this longitudinally, we can begin to unpack what comes first. You know, and these are very interesting questions. And there is no question that mental health is intimately tied with marital happiness. So, for example, one of the best treatments for depression is marital therapy. You know, these things are just really tightly linked. And I think we're going to begin to have an idea of how they influence each other over the course of a relationship.
You know, we've been talking about the way couples argue, but what about couples who don't argue?
Let me just tell you that quickly, that before we did this study, we did another study. This was a study that John Gottman and I did with a different sample. And we looked at couples who didn't argue at all, and we compared them with ones who argue kind of like everybody else does. And when we looked at 7 years out, the arguers divorced much, much more frequently than the non-arguers. When we waited and looked at 14 years out, the non-arguers totally caught up with the arguers. So I don't know what the take-home message is there, but my guess is that it's going to come back to haunt you at some point anyway. So you might as well learn how to argue in an effective way.
Yeah, and I think, you know, one piece of speculation is that couples who are not arguing on the surface may have a lot of resentment or anger, frustration simmering beneath the surface. And so while in the immediate it may look like a rosier picture, or it may feel on a day-to-day basis like a rosier picture because of being able to kind of scoot out of the way of that really aversive experience of fighting with someone, that over time, as Bob was alluding to, it's going to come out, you know, and perhaps in even sometimes more explosive ways.
And maybe that may be the kind of thing that's really going to have a strong relationship with mental health and physical health. You know, we know that just in general from a lot of research, powerful negative emotions that are not allowed out, you pay a price over time.
Paul writes, I had the ironic and sad experience of being married to a psychiatrist who was conflict avoidant in her personal life. Never an argument, my naively thinking that things were fine, and it just exploded at one point. I was shocked. I suppose this raises another question, which is, there are a lot of people who think that if you go to couples therapy, it's an acknowledgement that the relationship is on the rocks and over. But can there be a benefit to going into couples therapy without some huge problem that's threatened to blow up or that has blown up like an affair?
I mean, I would say absolutely. Of course, I'm biased because this is what I do. But, you know, I think there's absolutely a benefit in that. You know, as I was alluding to, we all get into these patterns of relating, and the opportunity to just take a look at what those patterns are and be able to engage, you know, as human beings compared to other animal species, we have these incredibly large frontal lobes, and they enable us to make decisions and you know, be metacognitive and reflect on how we think and how we interact, and to be able to harness that through couples therapy or just through being conscientious as a couple and talking about patterns of interacting, I believe there's definite opportunities to just optimize, not just fix. So whether you're a couple who's in a crisis or a couple for whom things are going well, I think it's highly useful to engage in an active dialogue about, you know, how are we getting along and how does this fit with how our vision for what our relationship should be like or could be like or we want it to be like.
Yeah, I think if you ask most couples therapists what the greatest frustration is in their work, it's that couples don't come in soon enough. And by the time they come in, it's really hard to repair.
Carl tweets, often marriage comes before individuals know themselves. It's hard to join and expect anything other than trouble. Marry later. Thoughts?
Yeah, I think there's some wisdom in that. So let's just for argument's sake, assume that we've discovered the silver bullet here. Of course we haven't, and that the key to a successful marriage is being able to calm down the wife, or let's say both, after an argument. Now let's sort of rewind the tape and think about courtship patterns, you know, and how important being able to calm down is in as we're sort of making the shopping list for our prospective mates. I mean, I think this is one of the challenges is that early in life, we really are looking for other things in mates, you know. We're not really thinking about what life is going to be like 30 years down the road. You know, we're looking for the glitz and the sparkle, not for the ability to be calm and comfortable together. So You know, the caller, it's a very real challenge. I mean, how do you choose a mate early in life who's going to work for you, with you, for the long haul? Because what's going to become important is going to radically change.
Well, this brings us back to the divorce rate of 50%. It seems to imply that it's an impossible task to try to make that judgment.
And here's another piece of sad news, is that second marriages are less successful in terms of divorce than first marriages. So the caller thinks, well, the caller's saying something different. He's saying wait until later. I think that might – I don't know the data on that, but that would be interesting to see. Certainly as you get older, if you remarry, you tend not to do as well. But I don't know about – you know, we've been talking about looking at late life newlyweds. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, that has not been hardly studied at all. So the caller should write a grant and study this. This would be great.
You heard that, listener, I hope. Sheila from Oakland has this question. What is it you guys do in couples therapy?
You know, that's a great question. I mean, when I think about my role as a couples therapist, and this is not rooted in a specific theoretical orientation to couples therapy, of which there are many, it is actually sort of that process I've been alluding to of helping couples to identify and take a look at and assess and evaluate their habitual automatic patterns of interacting and ways of viewing one another and talking about it and potentially molding and changing it with them.
I suppose this rolls this could launch a whole new conversation, a whole new hour. I don't think we can go past this one. But what are we learning about genetics that factors into this question of how couples survive together?
Well, we just published from this same sample a very interesting paper on that very point. And so we were interested in the gene that determines how we regulate serotonin, which is one of the real important mood-related neurotransmitters in the brain. And this will be the 2-second version of genetics, but there exists in the population at any given time naturally occurring variants that in genes like the serotonin transporter gene. And some of us have one variant and some have another. And for this particular gene, we were interested in people who had 2 short alleles. And I won't explain that, but it's about 30% of the population have them. Turns out these people are kind of extremely sensitive to their environments and they have big emotional reactions. And we found that in this sample, if you had these 2 short genes, your marital satisfaction over time was really powerfully influenced by the emotional quality of the relationship. If it was emotionally positive, you got happier and happier over time. If it was emotionally negative, you got more and more miserable over time. But if you had the other variants of the genes with the long alleles, you were kind of invulnerable to the emotional quality. Your marital satisfaction was determined by something else. So we were able to pick up in this group of about 30% of the population, these are the people probably for whom emotion and maybe emotional calming is going to be extraordinarily critical. And I think this is the beginning of a brave new world of understanding more about how these genes, these tiny little things, influence such complicated social processes like whether or not our marriages are successful.
Carol emails, and I apologize, Carol, you have a long email. I can't get to all of it, so I'm going to zero in on part of it here. What is not being addressed is the persistent gender models and power relations that are reflected in the findings and the long-term impact of one gender always essentially giving in on males who then don't have to learn how to withdraw, resolve conflicts, and for females who are always tired of always having to give in, and there's no question it is giving in, and it's been going on for generations, thousands of years. Second, the study seems to ignore cultural variability. Can you provide more information on the cultural backgrounds of the couples?
You want to address the cultural background, and we can talk a little bit about the gender differences?
Yeah, of course, it's a great question. You know, when we end up doing research like this, we end up talking about the mean. And around that mean is all sorts of important variation. So when we put this sample together in 1989, and we took this snapshot of long-term marriages in the Bay Area, this is what they look like. And so that meant they were pretty well off, pretty well educated, pretty white. And so this sample, you know, is really about people like that. And does it generalize to people who are less well off, less well educated, people of color? I mean, we don't know. And what we can say from a lot of other research is there are some qualities that we all share as human beings. I mean, there's a lot of things that are like that. But then there's some powerful differences that are determined by culture. And in a study like this, we are really talking about a particular group and a particular time, and time will tell whether or not this is human nature or whether it's a narrow piece of the picture.
More studies coming up, perhaps, that look at different cohorts?
Yeah, starting another 20-year study tomorrow. We've actually done quite a bit of work with couples from different cultural groups. And, you know, there are some really interesting differences in the way they manage conflict and they regulate emotion.
Any last words?
You know, just to acknowledge what the person who wrote in said, that I think that I understand that sort of palpable frustration with the sense that women are the responsible ones emotionally in marriage. And that's certainly what the research has borne out, is that women are perceived as more capable, as more responsible for regulating that affective balance. And that's can feel burdensome to someone. So I just wanted to acknowledge that.
Well, lots more to talk about. But I want to thank you both, Professors Robert Levinson and Leon Block. Thank you for being here today.
Thanks for having us.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and the executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Rachel Miro, in for Dave Iverson. And this is Forum on KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.